You are listening to Mountain Money, broadcasting on KPCW, Park City, Utah. Good morning. You are listening to KPCW. This is Mountain Money. My name is Allison Kulo, and I'm here with Roger Goldman. Good morning, Roger.
Good morning, Allison. It is a sunny but still snow-covered day here in Park City. I didn't see the guns going much over the weekend, but I think all of us are excited for the upcoming ski season. But meanwhile, today we have a really interesting show. What do we got, Allison?
Well, we're going to start off with Wall Street expert and author Scott Gamm. He's joining us to talk about his new book, Overcome AI, How to Build a Secure Financial Future in the Age of Artificial Intelligence. The book is truly a roadmap for financial literacy in the automation era.
Next, we'll be talking to Brandon Alfrey, a partner at Squire & Company. He joins us this morning to explain potential changes to current tax policy as a result of this year's election. And he will try to help businesses and individuals understand their tax situations as a result of those changes moving forward. Finally, we'll spend some time with Jessica McCleary, the owner of Mountain Town Olive Oil, located on Main Street in Park City since 2009. All this and more on this morning's Mountain Money. We'll be right back. Among many other changes going on in our dynamic environment, there are two important trends going on in society: financial independence and artificial intelligence. According to Scott Gamm, these two trends can make or break your financial future. Gamm's book, Overcoming AI, How to Build a Secure Financial Future in the Age of Artificial Intelligence, is a roadmap for financial literacy in the automation era. Gamm covers how AI will determine how much money you need to retire, the effects AI will have on 401ks, and why financial independence is of utmost importance in the age of automation.
Scott Gamm is the managing director of Strategy Voice Associates and started his career as a financial journalist. Most recently at Yahoo Finance, he reported live from the floor of the New York Stock Exchange and wrote about the financial markets. At The Street, he hosted a daily live markets show with The Street's founder, Jim Cramer. Scott has appeared as a financial commentator hundreds of times across television outlets, including NBC's Today, CNBC, Fox Business Network, C-SPAN, and many more. Scott is a graduate of NYU's Stern School of Business, and he's joining us this morning. Scott, thanks for joining us on Mountain Money.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, we are excited to chat with you this morning. And so I think, you know, let's start off first. You've got two main terms that you use in the book, and those terms are financial independence and artificial intelligence. Can you provide us with an overview of each of those?
Well, absolutely. You know, after the 2008 financial crisis, obviously that disrupted almost everyone's finances and made a lot of people take a closer look at how they were saving money, what their financial goals were. And there was sort of a movement that followed the financial crisis, primarily on social media, called the financial independence movement, where people were starting to share thoughts and communicate with others about the importance of really upping their savings game, right? So instead of saving, you know, 10% of their income, which is the typical advice we hear, they're going to save 50, 60, 70% of their income. And they're going to accumulate a large nest egg of assets that will eventually produce income for them so that they don't have to rely on a job for income. Now, some of them might keep their job and still working, and still work, or some of them might quit their job and pursue a lower paying passion, but at least they have that nest egg to kind of tie them over. So that was a trend that launched sort of after the financial crisis, and it's still going on now. But the other trend that has really expanded over the past decade or so is this reliance of AI on artificial intelligence or automation. And there's been a lot of worry about what that means for jobs. And so the way I approach this in the book is I kind of combine those two themes. So my thesis essentially is, you may have to pursue financial independence not because you want to, but you might have to right now because you may not have a job in 10, 15, 20 years because of all these changing tech trends that could be a threat to jobs.
Well, one of the things you talk about is that the key to accumulating wealth for financial independence is obviously increasing in savings rates. Talk a little bit about how that works and how that combined with compounding interest can actually lead to the accumulation of a significant nest egg over time.
Well, that's a very important point. And when you say over time, that is the key point, right? Because with compound interest, it's not so much how much money you save. Obviously, that's a big part of it. But it's really the time that you give yourself to save, right? So compounding interest works best when it's done over several decades. And that's why it's so important to start saving early, right? You know, if you start saving in your 20s versus your 30s, I mean, the difference in terms of what you'll end up with when you're age 60 is incredible. It's a big number, and we talk about that in the book. But, you know, the problem, though, when you start to think about, you know, AI and the changing nature of the workforce is that, you know, a lot of times we've been taught over the past, you know, several decades that, you know, if you just put a small amount of money away every year, by the time you're 60 or 70 over a 40 or 50 year period, you'll have enough money to retire. And that's true. The problem is that assumes that you're going to be able to work for that 40 or 50 year period. And I'm just encouraging people to rethink their sort of savings and work trajectory, meaning you don't know what the workforce is going to look like in 30 or 40 years from now. So while you have a job now, while you have that certainty, if you're lucky enough right now to have a job, because obviously the economy is in a pretty rough patch right now due to the pandemic, but you want to really start taking steps to think about how to increase your savings, how to, you know, get to that, you know, 40, 50, 60, 70% savings rate.
In the book, you really focus on AI, artificial intelligence, and you talk about how this concept will make achieving financial independence even more urgent. And you use the word urgent. Why is that?
Well, look, I would also just say, and I'm very clear about this in the book, we don't know what AI will mean for the future of work, right? This is all, for the most part, speculation, right? I mean, there's obviously a lot of high-profile business leaders that have come out publicly and sounded the alarm on AI as it pertains to the future of work. But, you know, it's really obviously hard to predict how this will all play out. What I try to do in the book is to just give people the information they need so that they can at least be aware of the trends that are going on right now and then start to make their own decisions. And I think the urgent word comes from what I was talking about earlier, which is that, you know, this assumption that we're going to have 40 or 50 years to save for retirement is, I think, a risky assumption. And so there is, you could argue, urgency to really start to double down on your savings strategy while you have a job right now to protect yourself from whatever may happen in the future, whether it's because of AI or because of some other threat. I mean, look what happened this year with the pandemic. I mean, a select number of industries were, you know, really proven to be in trouble, and no one really saw that coming, right? So, you know, that wasn't because of AI, it was because of a pandemic. So whether it's AI or some other shock that we don't know about, I think it's prudent to double down on your savings strategy now and not just assume that you'll have all the time in the world to deal with it.
Let's take it down a level in terms of the potential for AI to disrupt common employment. One of the examples you talk about in the book is an Uber driver, someone who has found employment in a gig economy by getting behind the wheel and choosing the hours and the times that they work. But AI could threaten that with respect to the self-driving car. So let's talk about some examples like that and how you see that really giving a potential for massive disruption in the employment landscape.
Well, you know, in that example was really to illustrate, you know, that, okay, these ride-sharing platforms are new, right? It's a new technology. And there's even the potential for disruption in that space because of AI, right? It's not just industries or, you know, jobs that have been around for decades. I mean, here's an example, right? The gig economy that's relatively new that could be disrupted by AI. And, you know, the other thing to keep in mind is just going back to the earlier point I was talking about the uncertainty surrounding AI, right? We just don't know what the impact will be on jobs. And the other thing we don't know about is sort of the political ramifications for all this, meaning just because a technology can displace a worker or can displace an industry, you know, will there be political will to stop that, right? And so that's the other thing we should keep in mind, that you know, just because a technology can do something doesn't mean we will allow it to, obviously, because there are obvious reasons why we cannot have AI displace millions of jobs. You know, that's obviously brings about tremendous societal problems that we're all going to have to sort of deal with if it appears as though that's the direction we're going in. So that is one sort of caveat in all this, that just because a technology can do something doesn't mean it will.
Although I suppose the history of this country has demonstrated that whenever technology could do something, it did. Let's talk for a minute, though, about one of the reasons that struck me as to how real this potential for massive disruption was your observation about how certain big companies are investing massive amounts of money in retraining their employees for a different kind of workspace. Who are those companies and what kinds of things are they doing?
Well, you know, this is a really important point because it's, you know, when you look at sort of the companies that are responsible for employing, you know, tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands of employees, I mean, you want to pay attention to what they're doing, right? Because at the end of the day, they decide, they control a pretty large percentage of the employment in this country. So if they're doing something, you know, we want to be aware of that, or at least try to read the tea leaves so we can kind of not predict what's going to happen, but at least not be caught off guard when something happens. So when you see companies come out and say, okay, we're going to spend, you know, X number of dollars retraining our workers, well, you know, that clearly gives you some sort of indication that, well, maybe the existing sort of skill set of, you know, certain employees in certain sectors is not commensurate with the technology that we have now. And so you almost have to wonder, okay, well, if those workers aren't going to be retrained, then what's the alternative? Is it AI? Are those workers just out of luck? And so I think it's a good thing to see companies investing in their people, retraining them, reskilling them, so that perhaps the, you know, their competition with technology, you know, the gap between, you know, the shortcoming of the skill of the worker is not such a big gap between the skill of the robot, so to speak.
So one of the philosophies that, you know, your book is primarily based on is there is going to be a disruption of AI to the workforce. And at this point, perhaps the scope and depth we do not know. But if you can save, if you can look at saving in a different way than we have previously and look at it as, you know, you won't necessarily have 40 years to do it, you know, start saving now, that's kind of the angle that you start to investigate in the book. But there is a point in the book where you talk about universal basic income as a possibility to be able to, I guess, manage some of the disruption of this. Why did that come up as a possible solution?
Well, and also, Jen, that's a great point. And I also just say, you know, I don't take a premise in the book per se about, you know, whether AI will definitely be you know, sort of an impact on the future of work. It's more just showing people the trends and just kind of alerting them to this possibility, because it's so hard to sort of, you know, have a definitive stance on this issue right now because there is so much uncertainty. But when it comes to universal basic income, you know, I brought that up in the book because, you know, that was an issue in the 2020 presidential election, you know, during the primary season. You had various presidential candidates that, you know, did not win the primary and obviously did not win the election, but at least that was a topic, universal basic income, that came up. And so I have noticed that theme gain some media attention, which I think is something to watch. Because essentially the thinking here is if you're going to have displaced workers, if that is the case, what are they going to do? And so does the government come in and just sort of pay them some sort of income so that they can support themselves? And so it's certainly a controversial topic, but I think that topic, when we're talking about, you know, AI and what it means for workers, is an important thing to at least be aware about and think about.
I think the candidacy of Andrew Yang really brought that to the forefront earlier. About 6 months ago, we had a really interesting interview here on Mountain Money with Annie Lowry, whose book, Give People Money, is a sort of a diatribe in favor of the notion of universal basic income. But as you say, that's a fairly controversial topic, and you have an interesting dialogue with a professor, I believe from NYU, where you sort of discuss the sort of ups and downs of UBI in the book. I wanted to ask about something else, though. You really talk about the notion that saving money for financial independence doesn't necessarily mean you anticipate going to the beach all day. Talk a little bit about that and what you think the real importance of that financial independence is.
Yeah, well, I'm so glad you mentioned that, because there's this misconception that, okay, well, I have enough money to quote-unquote retire, and that means I can just quit my job and not do anything all day. And I'm not a fan of that, right? I think once you achieve financial independence, whatever that number, whatever that means for your lifestyle, for your comfort level, doesn't mean you have to quit your job, right? You can still keep working, but at least you can work and not necessarily have to worry about money as much. Or maybe you do quit your job, but you pursue something else. You pursue a passion, or maybe you have a little bit more license to pursue a passion that's lower paying, and you can give yourself a little bit more time to, develop that business. So, there is an element in financial independence of people, you know, utilizing these strategies just so they can quit the job that they hate. But, you know, I'm all in favor of trying to achieve financial independence, but still continuing to work after that.
And that's probably a better philosophy to go with. From that point, you know, thinking of the listeners listening to this interview right now, many of them may say, well, I'm not in an employment sector that may be disrupted by AI, or I've got plenty of savings. I'm not concerned about this. But, you know, one of the items that you pointed out in the book is, if AI moves forward, and if robots essentially result in lower employment, less people will be paying income tax. And so you had drawn a correlation in the book between this outcome and impacts to 401k accounts. Can you explain the relationship that you highlighted in the book?
Well, you know, this is more, again, just kind of talking about the issue more broadly, meaning, okay, if, you know, we do see more unemployment and people are not getting paid from the job, okay, they don't have a job, so there's potentially a shortfall in tax revenue. You know, what are the implications of that, right, for the government, for society, right? Because obviously this tax revenue goes to providing a lot of services that all citizens rely on. So what is the government going to do? Do they start to tax the companies more that rely on this technology? Is that a solution to this? So, you know, I think there are so many sort of things to think about and potentially worry about. So I just wanted to sort of describe as many of the what-ifs as I could in this topic. But I think the core of our conversation today and what I talk about in the book is reminding people the importance of financial independence, financial responsibility, and taking the proper strategies and finding the right information to take control of your finances. Because at the end of the day, you can't control the trajectory of AI or the trajectory of technology, but you can control your personal finances.
You know, one of the premises of the book that we talked about earlier in this interview is the notion that by saving and taking advantage of compound interest, you can really gain in wealth. Well, we're in an extraordinarily low interest environment now, and the Fed has indicated that's going to continue for a while. So when we talk about 4%, 5%, 6%, 7% interest rates, what are your thoughts on how a normal person can achieve those kinds of rates to get the advantages we're talking about?
Well, I mean, a lot of that is likely going to come through, you know, some sort of an investment, whether it's in the stock market, through index funds or through individual stocks. A lot of people have a 401k that is invested in index funds. Real estate is another way that those in the financial independence movement, or, you know, those at least trying to pursue this, have been going about that. So, yeah, you're not going to grow your money, you know, if it's sitting in a savings account earning, you know, 0.5%, right? And obviously, with all the economic disruption we've seen this year, the Fed cutting rates to zero again back in March, and indicating that that you know rates near zero are going to be here for several more years, you know, that is sort of that's not the name of the game to just kind of hoard cash under your mattress, right? It you know, you need some sort of a growth aspect to this.
So we're wrapping up the time that we have with you this morning, but I do want to just highlight that this book does focus on quite a bit of an individual's basic financial health and talks about the best practices for saving and budgeting, credit card debt, and student loans. But as well, it also highlights lessons from billionaires about frugality. And frugality and being frugal is a piece that you talk about in the book. Can you share some of those ideas that came from the kind of billionaire's philosophy with regards to frugality?
Well, this was largely just some research I did. You know, there were a few billionaires who had been interviewed in news articles over the past couple of years, just talking about their frugality early on in their career, obviously before they became so rich. But I just thought it was fascinating to hear some of these stories of you know, people who went on to do great things and become very wealthy, you know, still have pretty frugal roots. And, you know, I think that that's sort of it was an important topic for me to end the book with, because again, in the book, you know, we're talking about, you know, what saving 50, 60, 70% of someone's income. And so that could be a pretty hard, you know, idea for people to swallow, right? Because that is a big sacrifice. It is a lifestyle change. You have to figure out ways to cut back on your spending or to increase your income so that you can start to put away larger sums of money than the typical, you know, 10%, you know, savings rate that we were all taught over the past several decades, which I think is rather antiquated advice at this point.
We've been talking with Scott Gamm. He is the author of Overcome AI, How to Build a Secure Financial Future in the Age of Artificial Intelligence. You've been listening to Mountain Money, and we'll be right back after this. Welcome back to KPCW's Mountain Money. Brandon Alfred, partner of Squires & Company, joins us this morning to help us understand changes we may see to current tax policies resulting from this year's election, along with any changes that addressing impacts of the pandemic. We're excited to have Brandon here this morning. Brandon, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, I'm looking forward to this conversation, at least from the outset. We'll see what you have to tell us and see if the excitement starts to wane. But when you...
I don't think tax people usually get that kind of a buildup. So you're probably making Brandon's day.
Yeah, this is like, I don't know. It's impressive to get as somebody wants to talk to a tax guy.
This exactly. Awesome. Go ahead.
Well, it's getting towards the end of the year. You know, these are things I'm thinking about. So I guess let's start from the election. When you take a broad look at the election results, what types of tax policies do you anticipate seeing in the coming years?
Well, you know, that's a really good question, because a lot of it still hangs in the balance, because the real question will be who controls the Senate. And so with the runoffs that are happening in Georgia, we'll have to see what happens there, because there's probably a different outcome if the Republicans still have control of the Senate versus the Democrats having control of the Senate.
So go ahead. Sorry.
You're good. When you've got a Republican-controlled Senate and a Democratic-controlled House and a Democratic-controlled White House, you tend to see a lot more gridlock. A lot of things move slower as far as immediate change. There's probably more of what we're used to right now of, you know, a lot of talk but not a lot of action that happens. And so we can anticipate, if the Republicans hold that Senate, that we may not see immediate change, and there may be a lot of negotiation that holds back. The negotiation will have to go back and forth as to what will need to happen as far as tax law changes. But a Democratic Senate would probably push things, move things faster than we would otherwise see.
There,
obviously during the campaign, the Democrats indicated, you know, some support for a number of changes, including, you know, changing the marginal rate back from the 2018 tax cut. I guess my question for you is this. Aren't there elements of existing tax law that are going to expire if nothing gets done? And what are those and what are the implications of that?
Yeah, so there are going to be, no matter what happens with tax law, there are things that are expiring at the end of the year. And this is kind of this happens quite a bit. You get things that just phase in and out or whatever, right? So there are some things from an individual tax perspective, right? There are a few things like the medical limitation, your adjusted gross income percentage that you're allowed to itemize on your individual taxes. That percentage is going to go up from 7.5% to 10% now after 2020. The other big one that's is there for individuals is that there's the you know, anybody who's claiming a qualified tuition deduction, is that's scheduled to go away currently at the end of the year, and so we don't know what that's going to look like. There's also provisions for businesses that are out there. Some businesses take advantage of certain credits that are scheduled to phase out. Like the work opportunity credit is going to phase out for certain employers who hire certain individuals. And then there's some energy credits. You know, we hear a lot about energy credits that they get sold a lot and said, hey, there's a big market for that. But a lot of those credits come up every couple of years for either renewal or just total phase out. And so some of those credits are scheduled to phase out. But as we usually typically see, a lot of these energy credits get extended and pushed forward another 2 or 3 years until we move forward a little bit.
Let me ask, do you have an observation as to why there is this tendency to have, you know, tax provisions with short half-lives? Why do they write legislation that way?
That's a really good question, because, you know, it would just make sense if we had a tax law and this is what it was and it didn't change very much. We like to call these provisions our Equal Opportunity Act for accountants. Well, we like that, but really what happens is that these are all just budget provisions that happen, right? Because they have to keep within a certain range within the budget of changes that they can make. And in order to balance out the effect of a tax law change or any kind of adjustment to tax policy, they make this adjustment and say, okay, we can put this in for a certain number of years, and then we'll have it phase out, and then something else will come in and replace that. And so it's really just this balancing act that they play within these tax laws to make sure that they meet the requirements of meeting the revenue neutrality rules that they have to have when they pass a tax law.
Some would call it a giant economic shell game by Congress's part, because this notion of scoring a bill and saying it's got to be revenue neutral in 10 years, I mean, they're not fooling anybody, including themselves, but nonetheless, this is currently how we do business. Let's talk a little bit about what, even with a Republican Senate, is there anything you can see changing in a small way on the tax front, possibly as a result of the pandemic?
Well, that's, you know, as a result of the pandemic's kind of changing everything, right? From how we work and how we live, and then now how we have to handle our taxes. And so what we can see is in the immediate future, you know, the talk is about having, you know, additional stimulus packages created to help businesses continue to survive until we can get to a point where things are more normal and businesses are back up and running. There are several businesses that have been hurt, several businesses that are still struggling, and it's not the intention to let them, you know, flounder and let them go. Unfortunately, they're part of the political game at this point. But really, from a tax perspective, what we see happening is more likely than not, it'll probably be additional loan packages and also probably more things like employment tax credits rather than individual, tax rate credits. There might be changes in business opportunities there. Like, for instance, when they passed the CARES Act, they changed some of the rules that were changed when the Tax Cut and Jobs Act went in about business losses being able to be carried back more years instead of being able to just push those forward. It's to help businesses recover a little bit more quickly and do that. And that's really what the tax relief is for, is immediate help in situations. And the easiest way that they found to do that is to do that through employment tax credits, because it can put dollars in the hands of individuals and businesses more readily than having to file returns and wait for processes to get happened.
So I've actually been texting with our other co-host, who is not joining us this morning, but he's had some great questions with regards to how much or how might deductions for 401k and IRAs change as we move forward.
Yeah, and that's a really good question, because there are lots of opportunities that people take advantage of to use to reduce their taxes now. By contributing to these retirement plans, 401ks, IRAs, et cetera. Some of the things that are being talked about are some dramatic changes to those programs. And we don't know what that is going to look like for sure. But in the short term, what we find is that anyone who's looking to help to manage their tax burden a little bit, taking advantage of these tax deferred retirement vehicles can help to provide some of that tax benefit now, but the flip side is that there'll be a tax later on, when you go to take the money out of these retirement accounts. In the future, the discussion is to make it more available to people, to increase limits, because we know that the majority of the people across the country don't have enough money saved for retirement, and that puts a strain not only on the company or the country financially, but our individuals financially, but also the country because of the effects of Social Security and everything like that. And so the discussion has been to open up the contribution limits to those plans. And there's even some plans out there that would change the structure of those plans entirely as far as the resulting tax implications now versus later, and help people to put money away to retire and not make it so much about the tax benefit right at this immediate point in time.
It's interesting. The notion of facilitating and encouraging individual wealth accumulation for the purpose of protecting retirement strikes me as something that you might actually get a consensus on between Democrats and Republicans, but that may be naive thinking. The plans you're talking about, do you have a sense of where the partisan divide is with respect to those kinds of advances in terms of changing retirement plan regulation?
Well, I, with most of it, with any tax legislation, whether it be with retirement plans or any kind of major issues, right, it's always about what is the impact to the people who pay the most taxes usually. the difference of philosophies between Democrats and Republicans get involved in that of like who should pay tax and what's fair and what's not, and back and forth. And so there's not a specific trigger point that says, hey, everyone is hung up on one particular issue. It's more the fact that people see things differently, and learning how to compromise and look at the bigger picture is the most important part to make something like this happen, to actually set the country in a better spot and the individuals in the country in a better spot for living their life.
For most of us, year end brings on thoughts of holidays and families. Tax professionals have a slightly different perspective on what year-end means. So I want to talk about a couple of things that we normally think about year-end from a tax perspective. The first one is talk for a minute, just remind our viewers of the implications of the last tax bill on charitable deductions and this notion of stacking my charitable deductions into a single year so that I could actually get a deduction in certain circumstances.
Yeah, and this comes about because the tax law change from the Tax Cut and Jobs Act increased the standard deduction to more than double what it was before. So right now, in a married filing jointly return, that number is over $24,000. And so the notion of stacking is that you try to accumulate as many of your itemized deductions as possible between your state taxes paid, let's say your home mortgage interest, your charitable contributions there. You want to stack as much of those as possible to get you above that $24,000 limit into 1 year. And so if that means, you know, whatever you can do to get there, charitable contributions is probably the easiest way to do it, right? So if you can give your charitable contributions that you were going to give in 2021 in 2020, and that will get you over the $24,000 limit, it will give you a bigger tax deduction in 2020. And then in 2021, you would go ahead and take the standard tax deduction at $24,000 for married filing jointly. And then in 2022, you would do the same thing. You would go to stack and get to this itemized deduction number above that standard deduction limit. And so every other year, you're increasing your tax savings by moving things forward from your charitable contribution standpoint, ahead 1 year to get to make a bigger impact on your tax. And so the notion is trying to save the most tax over a long period of time rather than just save a much tax this year. And so when you use the stacking plan, we'll say, then you look at it over a, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7 year period to see what kind of tax savings it actually gives you, rather than just waiting each year and trying to decide what the best tax move is.
So looking at these tax implications, and especially in this now versus later situation, you know, normally at year end, many financial advisors recommend harvesting your losses, selling positions that might be at a loss to lower their taxes owed. So if taxes might be higher next year, should folks think about recognizing gains instead of taking advantage of what might be lower tax rates this year versus 2021?
Yeah, and this is the part where we tell everybody that it's great to work with your professionals, right, with your professional services providers. So with your investment advisors, with your CPAs, because it really comes into making a plan and running the numbers at this point. So for each individual, there's absolutely an opportunity to look to say, what's the biggest tax advantage now? And if harvesting losses makes the most sense now versus where it will be next year, then it makes great sense to start that process now. It's easier to do it now before the end of the year than to try to catch everybody to say, oh, wait a second, between Christmas and New Year's, when everyone doesn't want to really be paying attention to it. But start a plan now to start looking at those opportunities of are my investments something that are going to help my tax situation now if I harvested these losses, or should I wait at this point? And so even now, not knowing for sure what tax rates will be, you know, in the future year, next year, or the following year after that, we can still make those same kind of plans to say what makes the most both economic sense and tax sense to do this year or next year.
So knowing that many people in our community have been impacted by the pandemic, whether it be job loss or others, you know, with regards to people filing their individual taxes, what types of programs are in place that either provide additional relief or postponement of payments due to the pandemic?
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, the IRS likes to get all of our money as soon as possible, right? They don't like to postpone much that's there. So obviously last year they postponed filing deadlines and they postponed some of the payment deadlines. But really for individuals, the IRS hasn't changed much as far as payments and what options are there. If people are struggling and have something, an IRS bill to pay, the IRS does have programs that are available to make payment plans, to make agreements and offers to help to settle any kind of tax debt that's available at that point. Most importantly, the thing to do there is to start an open correspondence with the IRS to talk about those payment plans and what's available, and then any kind of penalty relief that they may charge because taxes weren't paid on time.
As we went into the election, there was a lot of discussion about potential changes to the estate tax. With the likely 50-50 at most split in the Senate, is that something you see likely on the horizon?
You know, we think the estate tax is a very good possibility of seeing probably the most tax change out of any of the tax laws that are there, especially if there is a Republican control of the Senate. They may offer some compromises in the estate side, and they may not. We don't know for sure, but we know that it is something that is definitely being looked at hard by the Democratic leaders, and they put out certain proposals and things that they would like to see happen, including rolling back the exclusion limits and some of the other gifting strategies that have been put in place over the last several years. They want to roll some of that back. And so we definitely see that as a place where there are opportunities for maybe the biggest change in tax law.
So I believe during the campaign, the issue of stepped-up basis was a hot one with respect to estate tax. Can you explain what that is and whether you think that is something that the Republicans would likely compromise on?
Yeah, for sure. So the concept of stepped-up basis is that when someone passes away, the assets that they hold, the basis that they had, which was the original cost of whatever the asset was, automatically becomes the fair market value on their date of death. And so if you held a piece of property that was you originally bought for $100,000, and when you passed away it was $1 million, you would pass that to your heirs, and their basis in it would be $1 million. They could then sell it and not have the tax implication of that $900,000 gain that the individual who passed away would have had. And so it's been a huge part of estate planning for a long time to take care of that. There's a real, when we look at it, there's a real advantage to helping people understand that rule that's there. And we think it's a major shift in tax policy and change if that were to go away. And we think that's one of the huge sticking points in any compromise that the Republicans would make. And so we just don't know where that's going to go. I personally don't think that the Republicans would get into compromising on such a big issue, knowing that some of the age of our senators are probably planning on that provision as well to hand down money and assets to their families.
And just so the audience understands it, what that means as a practical matter is that gain never gets taxed, correct?
Correct.
Yeah, and I can see so that sort of sets the table for why there's controversy over that issue.
So I have one more question just to kind of wrap this up, and that's, with regards to people either putting together and starting to file their individual taxes or their business taxes, what is the kind of best advice you can give and advice that other tax accountants wish their clients would listen to with regards to starting to pull everything together and prepare for filing 2020?
Right. So the biggest thing is that it's important to talk to your tax preparer, your CPA, before the end of the year, just to figure out what your situation is and what you can kind of expect and kind of get on the same page before it becomes time to file. Because a lot of times when people pull their stuff together to file their taxes, most of the stuff is too little too late, and there's not much that we can do to help manage a tax bill. You can have an earlier conversation before the end of this year to see if there's anything that you need to be doing that could help your tax situation. That's the best thing right there. And then from there, it's just it's about communication and things that go on. So things happen as far as, buying and selling things, business opportunities, it changes in income throughout the year at every time. And communication with your CPA shouldn't happen just one time a year. It should happen, multiple times when things happen. And so you can make the best plan rather than trying to, hurry and rush one together at the last minute to try to save taxes.
Really appreciate your advice. We've been speaking with Brandon Alfrey. He is the partner at Squires & Company, and you've been listening to Mountain Money. We'll be right back after this.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. Jessica McCleary moved to Park City for a job with the Sundance Catalog. The former city dweller had a thriving career in retail, working with large-scale brands like Williams-Sonoma. And like so many of us, she expected her time in Park City to be temporary. But with an entrepreneurial spirit and a passion for culinary arts, Jessica soon decided it was time to follow her heart
and open a business. After noticing an olive oil store in Sedona, she thought a similar concept might work and on Main Street. So, since 2009, Mountain Town Olive Oil has been a place on Main Street for visitors to explore. The shop offers the visitors the opportunity to taste and explore and presents a new experience for those who stop in. Good morning, Jessica. Welcome back to Mountain Money.
Good morning. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Talk to us about years in business and, you know, how did the business grow and how did you end up with just Main Street being your principal location?
So when I opened my store in 2009, almost 11 years ago to the day that we're talking today, I really had no understanding or concept of what a big part of Main Street the store would become. I was hoping that, you know, people would notice my little storefront and want to come in and taste some really good olive oil and vinegar. What I didn't know then, but see very clearly now, is that it's an experience that people really enjoy and come back to year after year. We have tourists whose first stop in Park City is our store because they just love the experience of interacting with the products that they're about to buy.
And I think that's really been key to your success, is that it's not just walking in and looking at things. You actually allow the guests to be able to explore and to taste. And you have more than just olive oil. You also offer really an education in olive oil. Tell us about how the olive oil found in your business differs from those that we find on the supermarket shelves.
So about 10 years ago, UC Davis in California did a study analyzing the different qualities of extra virgin olive oil found at grocery store shelves versus higher quality California olive oils. The point of the study was to support California olive oils over imports. But basically, it was a stark realization, I think, for the industry, because the analysis included a lot of chemical elements that create extra virgin olive oil. Really long words that a lot of scientists understand. But at the end of the day, what was found is that a majority of store-bought olive oils are adulterated with canola oil or safflower oil, rancid olive oils that are flavored and treated to taste like extra virgin olive oil. Consumers in the United States never really understood the difference between high-quality extra virgin olive oil and the stuff on the grocery store shelves because we're not raised in the culture of extra virgin olive oil like they are in the Mediterranean. And so what we sell is some of the highest quality olive oils in the world, backed by scientific testing, the same tests that UC Davis ran on the grocery store olive oils. So there's a pretty easy compare and contrast right there.
I guess I grew up in an environment where not only virgin was a binary concept, but extra virgin would certainly be a binary concept. So this is this is an interesting observation. Let's talk a little bit about the store itself. And it obviously is some more than just olive oil. What are some of the other things in the store and I want to talk about? And then I want to get to your classes, which I personally have found to be very, very fun and enlightening.
Yeah, they're a ton of fun. We sell a lot of aged balsamic vinegars. And the balsamic vinegars are where a lot of people just have a lot of fun because most balsamic vinegars, again, that you buy at the grocery store are really acidic because they're not aged. So you get that really kind of screwed up look on your face where you're like tasting something really sour. Our balsamics are aged for a minimum of 12 years, so they're naturally sweet without added sugar. And then the flavors that are added make it a really rich experience. So my personal favorite is the lavender balsamic that I mix with the Meyer lemon olive oil for salad dressing. Our best seller is our 18-year aged balsamic, which, you know, a lot of people compare to some of the 25-year aged balsamics that they've seen in Italy that sell for $200 for, you know, a couple of ounces. We have some white balsamic vinegars, which are great in drinks or over fruit, on ice cream, things like that. So the world of flavor is really, it's big, and people have fun exploring it. We also sell a bunch of herbs and spice blends, gourmet foods, and then a whole side of the store is dedicated to gifts for the home and things like that.
So as Roger mentioned, you do have classes, and so the class is the next course. And you've been successfully hosting these during the past summer and fall. Tell us about these classes.
So we started doing the classes about 2 years ago with a local chef and caterer, and she writes five different recipes. Her name's Deanna. She owns Delicious Park City. She writes five different recipes for the class that incorporate all the oils and vinegars and spice blends and kind of shows people how to make them. People get to eat and drink. I have been taking wine classes and have learned how to pair the wines with different class, different dishes. So it's a lot of fun, a lot of education. With COVID, we basically reduced our class size from about 20 people to 8, socially distant tables, limiting interactions between staff and guests, masks, all of that. So it's been fun, and people have really enjoyed having something to do.
Are you anticipating being able to continue those, at least as of now, Jessica?
No, okay. Unfortunately.
That's a fair
idea. I don't think that there's any responsible way to bring disparate groups of people together into one room for 2 hours.
But that sort of takes us to an interesting segue. I don't know. I think my experience has been that, you know, more of us are staying home a lot, and we're getting tired of the same bland recipes and same bland things to cook. And one of the things that I've started to do is I go to your website and look at your recipes, because there are some really interesting recipes that the chef that you mentioned before, I think, has been responsible largely for putting up on the website. And they allow you to take interesting ingredients and do creative things at home. Talk a little bit about the range of what's available for home cooking advice.
Oh, my gosh. Our recipes on our website, I'm responsible for updating all of the recipes on there. So when you need something new, just give me a call and tell me to, you know, sit down at the computer and update some recipes. But yeah, we have done classes ranging from Moroccan food to Asian to Mexican street tacos to a taste of Italy and France and Spain. So a huge range of international recipes. Deanna is a classically trained chef and really understands how to add flavor into every dish. So when you do find some cool recipes on there, then you add the flavored oils and vinegars, it just makes everything pop. Although I'll tell people in the store, you know, you don't have to be a chef. You don't have to be, you know, a Martha Stewart to use these recipes. You can just make chicken and rice. But when you use the flavored oils and vinegars, it gives everything a new level of flavor.
Jessica, we've enjoyed spending time with you this morning. We've got maybe 20 seconds left. Small Business Saturday is on November 28th this year. Remind our listeners where they can find you, whether that be on the street or online.
Our store is located at 613 Main Street upstairs and online at www.mountaintownoliveoil.com.
Thank you, Jessica.
We look forward to seeing everyone in town that weekend.
And we enjoy seeing you. Jessica McCleary with Mountain Town Olive Oil.